Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Pfeffer of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses rising tensions between the Trump administration and North Korea that risks triggering a deadly regional conflict. Sarah Shore of the climate group 350.org, who talks about the campaign to stop the Keystone XL pipeline after President Trump reversed the Obama administration's denial of a federal construction permit. And Walt McCree, executive director and chair of the Public Banking Institute, who discusses a proposal for the establishment of a public bank in New Jersey made by a leading Democratic Party candidate for governor. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
French leftist Jean-Luc Mélenchon is surging in the final days prior to the first round of the French presidential election on April 23rd. The veteran left-winger has caught up with the front-runners, independent centrist Emmanuel Macron and the far-right nationalist anti-immigrant candidate Marine Le Pen. The top two candidates in the opening round will compete in a runoff on May 7th. Early polls show Macron, the former socialist economy minister, easily beating Le Pen in the final round. Mélenchon, who quit the Socialist Party in 2008, calls for reducing the French work week from 35 to 32 hours, lowering the retirement age to 60, and taxing earnings of more than $35,000 a month at 100%. His campaign also advocates the phasing out of nuclear power, which currently supplies 75% of French electricity needs. On foreign policy, the leftist calls for a new role for France in the EU, withdrawal from NATO, and warmer ties with Russia. The outcome of France's presidential campaign remains unpredictable, with many voters repudiating the established political parties on the left and right. Turnout for the April 23rd election is expected to be critical in determining the winners. During a tour of a military camp, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte raised eyebrows when he promised to occupy uninhabited islands and reefs in the disputed South China Sea, in a move seen as countering China's increased military presence in the region. China immediately objected to what it perceived as a provocation in the tense Spratly Archipelago, a critical shipping lane in the Asia Pacific. Quickly, the Philippines Defense Minister, Delfin Lorenzana, clarified that the islands in question had been controlled by the Philippines since the 1980s. The Manila government said it would be building new water and sewer systems on the islands, but would not be deploying any offensive weapons. The flip-flopping on the South China Sea, coupled with Duterte's dismissal of calls from the international community to end his brutal crackdown on illegal drugs, could further isolate the Philippines from its traditional allies, like the United States and Europe. Duterte plans to visit China in May. America's urban heroin crisis has disappeared from public view as addiction in white America has surged, receiving newfound compassionate attention from many conservative politicians. Yet African Americans and Latinos quietly suffer, largely out of the public spotlight, from a heroin epidemic driven by poverty, lack of substance abuse treatment, and AIDS. The number of heroin addicts is growing and can now easily be found in both middle-class enclaves and in poor rural communities alike. Since 2000, the number of heroin overdoses by white addicts has spiked by over 500%. According to the news magazine In These Times, the frequency of drug deaths among African Americans has doubled over the last decade. On the poor west side of Chicago, it is commonplace for suburban whites to search for a heroin fix. Yet in Illinois, African Americans die from drug overdoses more frequently than whites. Advocates such as Katie Kane Willis of the Illinois Consortium on Drug Policy say a leading culprit in the racial disparity of drug overdoses are budget cuts targeting substance abuse treatment programs and the high number of blacks and Latinos who lack basic health insurance. But unlike the 1980s and 1990s, where arrest and incarceration were the public policy of choice for those who used crack and other illegal drugs, the policy advocated by right-wing politicians today for opioid users is treatment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As North Korea celebrated the 105th birthday of its founder, Kim Il-sung, on April 15th, tensions rose to a dangerous level on the Korean peninsula. In response to a failed missile test and concern about a possible sixth nuclear weapons test, President Trump deployed a U.S. aircraft carrier task force to the waters off Korea and issued several threats against the regime of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Mr. Trump accused the North of looking for trouble and ominously warned that if China did not assist in reducing the threat posed by Pyongyang's nuclear program, then the U.S., he said, will solve the problem without them. News reports, later denied by the White House, stated that the Trump administration was, for the first time, considering using conventional weapons to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea if the country was about to conduct another nuclear weapons test. In response, North Korea promised to retaliate against the U.S. with a nuclear weapon if Washington launched a preemptive strike. Later, Vice President Mike Pence, visiting Seoul, South Korea's capital, warned that North Korea should not test the strength of the armed forces of the United States in this region, while also leaving open the possibility of negotiations. Your reporter spoke with John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses rising tensions between the Trump administration and North Korea that risks triggering a deadly conflict on the Korean Peninsula and across the region.
You know, wars often break out not because of rational calculations, but because of irrational desires or ambitions, emotional responses, revenge. So, everybody who on this side of the Pacific, who is kind of thinking about the Korean Peninsula, recognizes that a war would be devastating not only for North Korea, but devastating to U.S. allies, South Korea and Japan, would be a self-inflicted wound if the United States were to start such a war. And I think everybody in North Korea realizes that the same holds true there, that an attack by North Korea against the United States, managed to somehow do that, or against South Korea or Japan, would also be a self-inflicted wound. And yet, despite that understanding, it's still very possible for a chain of events to escalate and produce an effect that no one wants, which everybody blunders into, much like, say, World War I.
John Pfeffer, how would you assess the threat posed to the United States and U.S. allies in Asia by North Korea at this point?
Well, I don't think North Korea poses any threat to the United States. Honestly, because its missiles can't reach the United States. It can challenge, for instance, the 28 to 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. It can challenge U.S. allies in South Korea, Japan. But a direct threat to the U.S. homeland? No, not at this point. North Korea can be devastating in its attack on South Korea. It has a huge amount of artillery positions stationed just over the border, within firing distance of Seoul, and that would be terrifying. I mean, there's approximately 20 million people who live in the greater Seoul area, so any kind of attack that would involve Seoul would be just catastrophic. So I think that's one of the reasons why the United States has effectively avoided any kind of thinking about preemptive strikes against North Korea, because it knows that any retaliation against South Korea would be, even if it didn't precipitate further war, it would still lead to enormous civilian casualties.
In a recent article, you talked about some of the ways that a negotiated solution to the tensions in the Korean Peninsula might be able to move forward. And I'm wondering if you'd summarize a bit of what North Korea is looking for and where some kind of deal might be able to be struck in the future.
Sure. Well, basically North Korea wants to end its isolation. It doesn't want to be isolated militarily. It doesn't want to be surrounded militarily. It doesn't want to be isolated diplomatically. It wants, to achieve international recognition as a legitimate state. and it doesn't want to be isolated economically. The regime of sanctions has prevented international capital from entering the country and helping rebuild the infrastructure, the industry, the agriculture. So it sees the United States largely as the kind of key player in reducing its isolation. The United States is the most powerful country in the world. It holds the keys to the international economy. If the United States were to recognize North Korea diplomatically, its allies would follow suit. So that's what North Korea wants. It wants a deal with the United States that could end its isolation. In order to kind of to secure that with North Korea, however, the United States is going to have to step back from the precondition that the Obama administration placed on North Korea, and that was for North Korea to get rid of its nukes before it can even get to the negotiating table. That's a non-starter. The other thing is that there has to be a gradual process of denuclearization at this point, because North Korea is not going to give up its single bargaining chip, its single most important deterrent, just on the promise that the United States will treat it fairly. So I think those are the kind of key elements for any negotiation going forward.
South Korea has gone through a lot of political turmoil in recent months, and their leader, their Conservative Party leader, has stepped down. There's a new election coming up, and it's possible that a newly elected South Korean president could be an advocate of the old sunshine policy, which favored rapprochement with North Korea. How could the coming election in South Korea change or reduce the tensions on the peninsula there?
Yeah, it's an important question. I mean, basically, South Korea had 10 years of conservative rule that ended with Park Geun-hye being impeached and thrown into jail on corruption charges. And those 10 years were effectively a step away from the sunshine policy, a step away from engagement with North Korea diplomatically and economically. We're going to see a new president, probably someone of the center left, like Ahn Cheol-soo, or even more progressive, like Moon Jae-in, both of whom I think support a much more engagement-friendly approach to North Korea. I think there's also a wellspring of public sentiment at this point to try something new. The last 10 years were not successful, really, in changing North Korean behavior or in advancing reunification in any meaningful way. We saw the closure of some important projects like the Kaesong Industrial Complex, an economic cooperation program between North and South Korea. So I think people are saying, hey, the hardline policies, they didn't really work. I think it's time for something new.
That was John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of The Future of U.S.-Korean Relations. Find more perspectives on North Korea's nuclear weapons program and the future of a negotiated solution by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In November 2015, President Obama announced his decision to deny a permit to the TransCanada Company, which needed it to build the Keystone XL pipeline across the Canadian border from the Alberta tar sands mining operations to where it would connect to an already existing pipeline in Nebraska that had been earlier approved and built under Obama. The permit denial was considered a great people-powered victory for the climate movement, as it brought together environmentalists, property owners along the route of the pipeline, ranchers, farmers, and indigenous communities in the upper Midwest. Then, as one of his first acts as president, Donald Trump resurrected the Keystone XL, promising thousands of jobs, partly through using pipes made of U.S. steel, despite the fact that the company had already purchased pipes mostly manufactured abroad. The environmental group 350.org was a leader in the fight to kill the KXL pipeline the first time around, and is now gearing up to do so again. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sarah Shore, lead organizer with 350.org's Keystone XL pipeline campaign. Here she talks about the focus of the campaign this time, that revolves around a federal lawsuit, the pipeline permitting process in Nebraska, and the decreasing price of oil.
The strategy last time around was really to influence Obama. that was the 350 strategy, was to influence Obama. There were also lots of other groups working on other angles of the fight. This time, we know we're not going to be able to influence Trump. So we are organizing around other angles of this fight. The main ones that you'll see a bunch of pushback on are the federal lawsuit. Obama went through a multi-year process to determine whether the Keystone XL pipeline was in the public interest of Americans, and ultimately decided that it was not because it significantly contributed to climate change. And on that basis, rejected the permit after years of study. Trump spent 3 months reversing that decision. And so he actually didn't go through the proper processes, and Sierra Club and NRDC will be suing the federal government to basically make the argument that this was an illegal decision by the Trump administration that didn't actually take public comment or a real study into consideration, and that's illegal. So that'll be one leg that we'll be fighting on. Another one is Nebraska. The Keystone XL pipeline does not have a legal route through Nebraska. It has not been permitted through the state of Nebraska, and the Public Service Commission has to actually determine that Keystone XL is in the public interest of Nebraskans, and that is a process that's happening now in the state. We, as 350.org, are interveners in that process. There are also dozens of landowners and several organizations that have been approved as interveners in that process, and we will be generating public comments and putting a ton of pressure on the Public Service Commission in Nebraska to stop this pipeline. If they do approve it, there are about 85 landowners in Nebraska who have not given up their land to easements to TransCanada, who the state will be using eminent domain to take their land to build this pipeline, and they will be suing the state of Nebraska to say this is not in our public interest. So that's another leg. And then I would say the third leg, which is maybe the most important one, is Keystone XL has mobilized millions of people over the last several years to take action on climate and on fossil fuel issues. And it helped spur dozens of other fights against other fossil fuel pipelines across the U.S., across Canada, across the world. And revitalizing this fight on Keystone will only help us build the movement across the board. Just like what happened in the past when fighting Keystone helped us build the movement to fight several other pipelines at once, that's going to happen again, and we're only going to see more and more fights against the fossil fuel industry being taken on because Trump has now brought this fight back to center stage.
Sarah Shore, the economics from TransCanada's point of view seem to be worse than they were when the company started this process more than 10 years ago. For one thing, the price of oil has dropped significantly.
Absolutely. This pipeline isn't needed. The economics behind it are incredibly poor. That could absolutely play a role in whether this pipeline gets built or not. Also, you know, the price of extraction of tar sands, which is one of the dirtiest fossil fuels in the world, is really expensive. It's really costly to extract. It's really costly to transport. It's really costly to refine. And this pipeline just isn't needed. The economics behind it are not there, and it doesn't make sense to build this pipeline.
How big a role do you think the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline will play in the People's Climate March in Washington, D.C. on April 29th? I know 350 has been heavily involved in organizing it.
I mean, I think that a lot of people came into this movement because of the Keystone XL pipeline, and they will be there at the People's Climate March marching. There will be a big fossil fuel resistance block within the march that will probably be much themed around Keystone XL and other infrastructure projects. And ultimately, this fight is bigger than one pipeline. New fossil fuel infrastructure projects are facing resistance everywhere, and Keystone will once again stoke the flames of all of those other fights.
That was Sarah Shore, U.S. Keep It in the Ground campaign manager with the climate group 350.org. Learn more about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the meltdown of the U.S. and much of the world economy in 2008 and 2009, movements including Occupy Wall Street emerged that condemned Wall Street for its role in exacerbating growing income inequality in America and abroad. Beyond simply slamming the system, some progressive economists and activists put forward a number of ideas for restructuring the U.S. financial and banking system that offered alternatives for a more equitable model to better serve the interests of consumers, small business, and the nation as a whole. Among those ideas was support for a government bank that would offer competition to the nation's largest privately held banks that recklessly engaged in casino-like gambling and lost billions of dollars of their customers' investments during the Great Recession. The public banking option comes from the successful example of the 98-year-old Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only statewide publicly owned bank. Some observers credit North Dakota's public banking system for the state's large budget surpluses during the economic collapse. Your reporter spoke with Walt McCree, executive director and chair of the Public Banking Institute, who discusses the recent proposal for the establishment of a public bank in New Jersey made by Phil Murphy, a former Wall Street executive who's now a leading Democratic Party candidate running for New Jersey governor.
A public bank is a bank that's owned by the people, owned by the public. And typically, in the instances that we refer to it, it's owned by the cities or the counties or the states that own the bank. So that instead of shareholders and stakeholders, you have the citizens who are the ones who use the bank and benefit from the bank just as if they had a private bank. And the power of that is that the franchise of banking is basically a license to create money. You know, it's a proven franchise that works brilliantly, and of course it can be misused. But the public's potential here is to be able to keep the money that is collected as taxes and fees and license, all the money that comes over the transom of the body politic, is kept at home in our own bank instead of sent off to Wall Street. And, of course, when Wall Street gets the money, they go off and they use it to leverage and make profits and play the global casino of speculation. And, you know, they do very well. And they do that with our money. What the public bank does is basically gives it a new place to go so that the city and the county, the state can design, create, and fund the finance itself for things like infrastructure or student lending or perhaps affordable housing, a host of things that all of us know that we'd like to have our communities be able to do but haven't had the money to do that. So it's quite a new day. There's only one public bank in the United States at the moment. That's the Bank of North Dakota, which has been called the most profitable bank in America. It outproduces by 70 to 100% the return on equity of the Wall Street banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs. It's a highly productive bank that has been financing North Dakota and stabilizing that economy for 98 years.
Since its founding in 2010, yourself and Ellen Brown, the founder of the Public Banking Institute, have been proselytizing across the country, advocating for public banks to be established elsewhere apart from North Dakota. Now we have a Democratic candidate for governor in New Jersey, Phil Murphy, who's really made establishing a public bank in New Jersey one of the centerpieces of his campaign to win the governorship there. Maybe you could tell us about what's going on in New Jersey and if you're optimistic that we can finally have a second public bank established in another state after all these years.
Yeah, we get a new one every 100 years. You know, it's a trend.
Yeah.
Actually, Phil Murphy's candidacy in New Jersey is big in many ways because it has mainstreamed the awareness of what a public bank is, as well as brought it into even a mainstream political environment. Phil Murphy has a Goldman Sachs background. He's a banker. And as Ellen Brown says, you know, the reason he gets it is that he's a banker. He knows how banks work and how it can be used. His candidacy is doing very well. You know, he seems to be the odds-on favorite to win. He's very serious about it. New Jersey is a rich state, but it's in a basket. You know, it's in a basket case. It has huge debt. Murphy feels that by having a public bank, they'll do exactly what I said earlier. We'll keep our money in the state, invest in ourselves, finance ourselves. So we're really very hopeful. And the people and the vibe in New Jersey is very strong, strongly in favor of it. Certainly, there are people pushing back, but those are often people from the Wall Street and the big banks and the other side of approach here. Around the country, there are over 50 initiatives underway now. It's really a growing movement, and it is indeed a movement. I mean, we have the city of Santa Fe is getting very close to the point where they're going to be assigning a task force to be able to move forward with the charter, to get a bank charter there. In Philadelphia, that is also right in the middle of the city council at the moment. Oakland, Portland, Seattle, about 9 cities in California, including the state, Arizona, New Mexico, Albuquerque, and Santa Fe, I mentioned. Minneapolis is taking a look at it. There's Massachusetts, also Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, Maryland, and the state of Pennsylvania are the ones that come to mind. I've left out Michigan and Illinois, but you get the picture. It's a pretty exciting prospect. Not happening too soon.
That was Walt McCree, Executive Director and Chair of the Public Banking Institute. For more information on the public banking option, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, KEXP in Seattle, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.